This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Directorate S, the CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan, by Steve Cole. Read for you by Malcolm Hilgartner. In memory of Robert and Shirley. Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows that the war is over. Everybody knows that the good guys lost. Leonard Cohen, Everybody Knows, 1988. Author's note. Two extraordinary colleagues contributed deeply to this book. Christina Sikowski, who earned an undergraduate degree at Wellesley College and a master's degree at Georgetown University, carried out important interviews and document analysis for more than 2 years. She was singularly responsible for the rich interviews that inform Chapter 26, among many contributions. I could not have finished the book without her. The same is true of Elizabeth Barber, a graduate of the Honors College at the State University of New York, who also earned a master's degree from Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. Among other things, Elizabeth carried out a 9-month fact-check of the manuscript, recontacting sources and reaching out to new ones. She used this reporting to improve the manuscript from start to end, adding new scenes and revelations, and pushing tirelessly for accuracy, nuance, and completeness. Although I am solely responsible for what appears in these pages, Directorate S belongs to Christina and Elizabeth as much as it does to me. There are other important colleagues from Columbia and elsewhere who made vital contributions. I thank them all. Introduction. In 1989, I moved to New Delhi for the Washington Post to become the newspaper's South Asia correspondent. I was 30 years old and responsible for a phantasmagoria of news from India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, and Nepal. For 3 years, I hopped from capital to capital and from one guerrilla war, coup d'etat, and popular revolution to another. It was thrilling and affecting work. In Afghanistan, the last units of the Soviet occupation forces had recently pulled out of the country. The war caused by the Soviet invasion had claimed an estimated 1 to 2 million Afghan lives, or up to 10% of the pre-war population. Landmines and indiscriminate bombings maimed hundreds of thousands more. About 5 million Afghans became refugees. Soviet and Afghan communists purposefully decimated the country's educated elites, executing or exiling traditional leaders. By the time I turned up, this culling had left much of the field to radical preachers and armed opportunists. In Kabul, the Soviets had left behind a few thousand KGB officers and military advisers to prop up a regime led by Mohammad Najibullah, a physician-turned-secret police chief. Najibullah's forces controlled the Afghan capital and an archipelago of cities. The countryside belonged to the Mujahideen, the anti-communist rebels funded and armed by the CIA, as well as by Pakistani and Saudi intelligence. The war had settled into a grinding stalemate. The Soviet troop withdrawal knocked the Afghan story off front pages and network broadcasts in the United States, but for the Post, it remained a matter of running interest, not least because the CIA was still smuggling guns and money to the rebels. The agency's career officers and analysts were among our subscriber base in Washington. Like other correspondents in those years, I covered the Afghan war from both sides. I flew periodically to Kabul to interview Najibullah and his aides, or to travel around the country with Afghan communist generals. From Pakistan, I went over the border to see the Islamist rebels' hold on the countryside. The work was generally safe, as correspondence from a medium-grade civil war goes. Yet during this period, Western reporters and humanitarian workers learned to be wary of the loose bands of Arab Islamist volunteers circulating among the Afghan Mujahideen. These international radicals sometimes staged roadside executions of non-believers they came across. We did not yet know them as Al-Qaeda. The CIA subcontracted its aid to the Afghan rebels through Pakistan's main spy agency, Inter-Services Intelligence, or ISI. By 1989, the service had grown into a powerful, corrosive force within Pakistan, a shadowy deep state that manipulated politics on behalf of the army and increasingly promoted armed groups of Islamists, including the Arab volunteers we had learned to approach cautiously. ISI officers were not easy to meet, but not impossible to track down either. I became somewhat obsessed with reporting on the underbelly of the Afghan conflict. I wrote for the Post about how the CIA program to arm the rebels functioned, why its escalation had helped to defeat the Soviet occupation, and how, simultaneously, CIA's covert action had empowered the more radical factions in the rebellion, largely at ISI's direction. In December 1991, the Soviet Union collapsed. The political upheavals in Moscow and Central Asia rippled into Afghanistan. Soviet cash, food, and arms supplies to Najibullah's government looked to be finished. This altered the civil war's balance. By late April 1992, the fall of Kabul to the ISI-backed Islamist rebels seemed imminent. I flew in. The Mujahideen flowed into the capital unopposed on a Saturday. Kabul's wary residents had been governed for a decade by an officially secular regime. Hoping to avoid a bloodbath, they greeted the entering long-bearded rebels with flowers. Najibullah tried to flee, but was arrested at the airport. His security forces took off their uniforms, abandoned their posts, and went home, trying to blend into the new order. The Mujahideen seemed uncertain initially about whether to trust their acceptance into Kabul. That first day of the takeover, I met a rebel straggler near the zoo. He said his name was Sayed Munir. He was carrying an assault rifle. He turned in circles and insisted that anyone who wished to talk to him do so from a distance of 10 feet. "Everyone is friendly," he admitted, "but maybe some people want to take my gun." He was right to be wary. That night, a new round of war erupted among factions of the Afghan rebels. The fighting soon shredded Kabul, claimed thousands more innocent lives, and consigned Afghanistan to yet deeper poverty and international isolation. America, by now absorbed by victory in the Cold War and startling geopolitical changes such as the reunification of Germany, looked away. I moved on as well, to London, to take up a position as an international investigative correspondent for the Post. I was stationed there on February 26, 1993, when a cabal of jihadists, some with ties to the Afghan war, detonated a truck bomb beneath the World Trade Center, killing 6 people and wounding many others. My editors asked for an investigation into the networks of Islamist radicals and financiers that seemed to lie behind the World Trade Center attack. I worked on some of that project with another reporter, Steve Levine. We heard about a wealthy Saudi exile in Sudan, Osama bin Laden, who was reported to be funding some of the groups we were looking into. Steve flew to Khartoum to ask for an interview. Bin Laden's bodyguard said he would not be available. After speaking with some of bin Laden's aides and many other supporters and members of the jihadi movement from London to the Balkans to the Middle East, we wrote, "Arguably, the best way to think about bin Laden's multi-story Khartoum guest house is not as a centralized, string-pulling headquarters, but as one among many scattered centers of gravity where militant Islamic radicals may find haven, succor, or support." We still had not heard of Al-Qaeda. Because of bin Laden's rising notoriety, the United States soon pressured Sudan to kick him out of Khartoum. He went to Afghanistan in the summer of 1996, declared war on the United States, and soon found shelter with the Taliban. By 2001, I had become the Post's managing editor in Washington. That spring, the paper carried coverage of the New York trial of jihadi conspirators who had participated in the terrorist attacks on 2 U.S. embassies in Africa in August 1998. The prosecutors introduced evidence of bin Laden's involvement in the terrorist plot, as well as his leadership of Al-Qaeda, which was at last identified publicly. A defector testified in detail about how Al-Qaeda worked and how bin Laden and his aides doled out support to followers and allies. Yet the conventional wisdom in Washington held that the group was isolated in distant Afghanistan, and that it was most likely to continue to carry out attacks overseas. Al-Qaeda was a serious nuisance, in other words, but not a major threat to American territory or security. On the morning of September 11th, I was at a desk in my home office in Maryland, typing notes for a book I was considering about genocide in Africa. I had CNN on mute on a small television to one side. When I saw the first reports about a plane that had smashed into the North Tower of the World Trade Center in clear weather, I assumed it was a freak accident. I scrambled to collect my keys and work materials, to rush to the newsroom. I was just about out the door when my wife called out as she watched United Airlines Flight 175 hit the South Tower. We stared at the terrible scenes for some minutes. "Oh, this is bin Laden," it finally occurred to me to say. I drove downtown. Smoke rose from across the Potomac River, where American Airlines Flight 77 had struck the Pentagon. 6 weeks later, I went digging around in my garage, looking for old tape recordings of interviews with ISI officers from the early 1990s. I found them. That discovery inaugurated research for the book that became Ghost Wars, The Secret History of the CIA, Afghanistan, and Bin Laden, from the Soviet invasion to September 10, 2001. My intention was to provide Americans, Afghans, and Pakistanis with a thorough, reliable history of the often secret actions, debates, and policies that had led to Al-Qaeda's rise amid Afghanistan's civil wars and finally to the September 11th attacks. I traveled back to Afghanistan and Pakistan to conduct some of the research. Ghost Wars came out in 2004. At the time, Afghanistan and Pakistan appeared to be stable and relatively peaceful. During the next several years, the Taliban and Al-Qaeda revived, plunging Afghan and Pakistani civilians into further violent misery and insecurity. It seemed evident that ISI was, once again, interfering secretly in Afghanistan, exploiting the country's fault lines, and that the United States government, including the CIA, was again unable to forestall an incubating disaster. The Bush administration and then the Obama administration gradually escalated America's commitment to suppressing the Taliban and defeating Al-Qaeda. Ultimately, hundreds of thousands of Americans volunteered to serve in Afghanistan after 2001 as soldiers, diplomats, or aid workers. More than 2,000 American soldiers died alongside hundreds of contractors. More than 20,000 soldiers suffered injuries. Of the much greater number who returned safely, many carried questions about whether or why their service had been worthwhile, and why the seemingly successful lightning strike American-led war of late 2001 had failed to vanquish the Taliban and Al-Qaeda for good. Directorate S, the CIA and America's secret wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan, 2001 to 2016, is intended to address those questions, as best the evidence allows. It is a second volume of the journalistic history recounted in Ghost Wars, starting from where that volume ended on September 10, 2001. The new book can easily be read independently, but it also seeks to deliver to readers of the first volume a recognizable extension of the subjects, narrative approaches, and investigations they encountered there. Directorate S seeks to provide a thorough, reliable history of how the CIA, ISI, and Afghan intelligence agencies influenced the rise of a new war in Afghanistan after the fall of the Taliban, and how that war fostered a revival of Al-Qaeda, allied terrorist networks, and eventually, branches of the Islamic State. The book also seeks to connect American, Afghan, Pakistani, and international policy failures to the worldwide persistence of jihadi terrorism. It tries to provide a balanced, complete account of the most important secret operations, assumptions, debates, decisions, and diplomacy in Washington, Islamabad, and Kabul. Like Ghost Wars, this volume asks the reader to traverse much territory. To keep things moving, I have again tried to prioritize action, vivid characters and original reporting, without sacrificing depth and context. After 2008, the United States and NATO allies fought a large-scale overt conventional war against the Taliban, and in a secret annex campaign, waged mostly by armed drones, against Al-Qaeda and its allies in Pakistan. This campaign could be the subject of a book in and of itself, and has been the subject of a number of excellent ones, including Little America by Rajiv Chandrasekharan, Obama's Wars by Bob Woodward, and The Way of the Knife by Mark Mazzetti, which also provides a penetrating account of the CIA during these years. In Directorate S, I have tried to offer new insights into that war, but not to recount it fully, concentrating instead on the less thoroughly treated trajectory of decision-making at the CIA, the ISI, and the principal Afghan intelligence service, the National Directorate of Security. I have also had to consider how to absorb, but not regurgitate, the vast body of excellent journalism already produced by other reporters about Afghanistan and Pakistan since 2001. I traveled repeatedly to both countries after 2005, while carrying out the research for what became Directorate S, but I cannot possibly match here the granular on-the-ground correspondence and books by the many intrepid field reporters and resident researchers who have done so much to deepen public understanding of South Asia's instability and political violence. I could not have written this volume without incorporating the insights and research of scores of other journalists and scholars, some of them colleagues and friends, including Ahmed Rashid, Peter Bergen, Dexter Filkins, Carlotta Gall, Anand Gopal, Felix Kuhn, Anatole Levin, David Rode, Owen Bennett-Jones, Sarah Chase, Graham Smith, Alex Strick van Linschoten, and Martina van Baelert, as well as many others cited in the source notes. However, I have concentrated the narrative in Directorate S on my own reporting, and principally on the hundreds of interviews conducted for the book during the last decade, as well as new documentary evidence obtained from those sources. I have sought to ground my reliance on interviews and contemporaneous notes with secondary sources, such as documents obtained from FOIA requests and the State Department cables released by WikiLeaks. For many Americans and Europeans who have lived and worked in Afghanistan and Pakistan before and after 2001, it is frustrating to hear discourse back home holding that Afghanistan and Pakistan are lands of warring tribes or endless conflicts. The historical record belies such clichés. Independent Afghanistan was impoverished but peaceful and stable, untroubled by radical international violence for many decades of the 20th century prior to the Soviet invasion of 1979. Its several decades of civil war since that invasion have been fueled again and again by outside interference, primarily by Pakistan, but certainly including the United States and Europe, which have remade Afghanistan with billions of dollars in humanitarian and reconstruction aid while simultaneously contributing to its violence, corruption, and instability. And for all of Pakistan's dysfunction, state-sponsored radicalism, and glaring economic inequality, it remains a modernizing nation with a vast, breathtakingly talented middle class and diaspora. If the army and ISI did not misrule Pakistan, in alliance with corrupt political cronies, the country's potential to lift up its own population and contribute positively to the international system might today rival India's. The region's endless conflicts are not innate to its history, forms of social organization, or cultures. They are the outgrowth of specific misrule and violent interventions. They reflect political maneuvering, hubristic assumptions, intelligence operations, secret diplomacy, and decision-making at the highest levels in Kabul, Islamabad, and Washington that has often been unavailable to the Afghan, Pakistani, American, and international publics. This is the story of Directorate S. Part 1. Blind into Battle. September 2001 to December 2001. Chapter 1. Something has happened to Khalid. In the late summer of 2001, Amrullah Saleh flew to Frankfurt, Germany, to meet a man he knew as Phil, a CIA officer. Saleh handled intelligence liaisons, among other tasks, for Ahmed Shah Massoud, the legendary Afghan guerrilla commander who was then holding out against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda from a shrinking haven in the northeast of his country. At 28, Saleh had a stern, serious demeanor. He was clean-shaven and kept his dark hair cropped short. He spoke English well, but deliberately, in a sonorous accent. Saleh typically met his CIA handlers at a hotel. He and Phil discussed a cache of spy gear the CIA had organized for Massoud. The delivery included communications equipment and night vision goggles that would allow Massoud's intelligence collectors on the front lines to better watch and eavesdrop on Taliban and Al-Qaeda fighters. The CIA had been training and equipping Massoud's intelligence directorate for several years, but the program was limited in scope. Under the policies of the Clinton administration and more recently the George W. Bush administration, the CIA could not provide weapons to support Massoud's war of resistance against the Taliban. The agency could only provide non-lethal equipment that might aid the agency's hunt for Osama bin Laden, the fugitive emir of Al-Qaeda, who moved elusively around Taliban-ruled areas of Afghanistan. One shipment had included a giant remote-controlled telescope. At another point, the CIA considered supplying Massoud with a balloon fixed with cameras to spy on Al-Qaeda camps. But between Afghanistan's heavy winds and the possibility that neighboring China might misinterpret the dirigible, they decided against it. Frankfurt was a logistics hub. The CIA's supply lines for Massoud were jerry-rigged and constrained by caution at headquarters. By early 2001, Langley had ordered CIA officers to stop flying in Massoud's helicopters because they weren't judged to be safe enough. Phil and his colleagues usually delivered equipment directly to Dushanbe, where Saleh ran an office for Massoud. Tajikistan was recovering from a bloody civil war, and there was occasional political unrest in the capital. That could make it difficult for CIA officers to travel there, but for the most part they found a way. Once in a while, however, they had to ask Saleh to pick up equipment in Germany and carry it the rest of the way himself. The CIA officers involved knew the German government was highly sensitive about anything the agency did on German territory without informing the BND, the principal German intelligence agency. But the supplies to Massoud were uniformly non-lethal. Some of the equipment might skirt the borders of export licensing rules, but it was not obviously illegal, as arms and ammunition would be. Massoud's lieutenants were experienced smugglers. Sometimes Saleh would have to figure out how to transport CIA equipment on his own. This made Saleh nervous. He did not relish answering the questions of German police or customs officers at Frankfurt Airport. "Where did you buy this?" He would have no answer. "Do you have any receipts?" "No." "What will you use these night vision goggles for?" It would be unwise to mention the Afghan war. "How did you obtain the funds to buy a $5,000 satellite phone and subscription?" Saleh had become an intelligence specialist only recently, but he was an avid student of the profession. In 1999, Massoud had selected him and eight other senior aides and commanders to travel to the United States to attend a CIA training course put on by the Counter-Terrorist Center under strict secrecy rules. Few people outside the center knew about it. The curriculum partly covered the arts of intelligence, identifying and assessing sources, recruitment, technical collection, analysis, and report writing. The paramilitary courses covered assessing targets, maneuvering and communicating in the field, and so on. In Nevada, the trainees climbed a mountain with a telescope to practice reconnaissance operations in conditions that replicated those in Afghanistan. The training reflected the CIA Counter-Terrorist Center's hope, a quixotic one in the view of many agency analysts familiar with Afghanistan, that Massoud's guerrillas might someday locate and trap bin Laden, even though the Al-Qaeda leader rarely traveled to the north of the country, where Massoud's guerrillas were. At the CIA school, Sully was a bit bored by the paramilitary instruction. He was more drawn to the craft of intelligence collection. He wanted a fuller understanding about intelligence systems and methods. He peppered the CIA officers on the faculty with questions. He found a few who were willing to give him extra time, and he tried to understand how the CIA worked. When the course was over, Sully went to Borders to buy a stack of books about spy services and intelligence history. Since then, he had earned respect at the CIA. The officers with whom he worked assessed Sully as tough, disciplined, honest, and professional, if also a bit young to command authority in Afghan society, which venerated age and experience. To solve his shipping problems in Germany, Sully tried to draw on his self-education, particularly concerning the methods of Israeli intelligence. Mossad had networks of helpers around the world, not just employees and paid agents or informers, but friends of the service who could be called upon for ad hoc favors. Sully telephoned an Afghan-German businessman in Frankfurt, whom he had cultivated for such assistance. "I have something I need you to do. I need your help," Sully said. The man suggested they meet at a hotel. "I won't lie," Sully said when they were settled. "It's equipment. If I'm lucky, I can take it out of Frankfurt Airport. If I'm unlucky, they will confiscate it." The gear was not lethal, Sully added, but it did constitute war equipment. "Brother, I had offered to help you, but not in smuggling," the businessman said. "This is not smuggling," Sully pleaded. "It's all plastic. There's no explosives, nothing. There are some goggles." Still, the man declined. He wished Sully luck. Sully transported the gear, which was about the size of a half sofa, to Frankfurt Airport. He booked himself on a flight to Tashkent, Uzbekistan, from where he would transfer to Dushanbe. This was typical of the struggle against the Taliban in which he and Massoud were engaged. They were fighting a DIY, do-it-yourself, guerrilla war. Massoud and his men had resources. The commander and many of his top lieutenants kept bank accounts in London and elsewhere abroad, according to CIA reporting, and Massoud was reported to control just over $60 million in London accounts. Yet they were effectively at war with the Taliban and Pakistan, a nuclear-armed state with a gross domestic product in 2001 of more than $70 billion. At the Lufthansa counter, Sully filled out forms. Then he answered many questions about his equipment. Had the CIA tipped off the Germans, and had the Germans agreed to go easy? He never knew. After a long colloquy, Lufthansa demanded only a considerable sum of money, which it calculated based on the weight of Sala's cargo. Amrullah Sala had grown up in Kabul in a poor family from the Panjshir Valley. He was the youngest of five brothers. At seven, he was orphaned. Like many Afghans who came of age during the Soviet occupation of the country during the 1980s, he knew political violence intimately. One of his brothers disappeared, executed by unknown parties. Another of his brothers, who was an Air Force officer, fell to an assassin in Kandahar. At 22, Sully joined Massoud's guerrillas in the Panjshir Valley. The Panjshir is a gorge that occasionally widens into a valley. It slices from the north of Kabul toward Tajikistan. A tight kin network of ethnic Tajiks inhabited the valley and scratched out livings as farmers, emerald miners, smugglers, and traders. By the time Sully arrived, the Soviets had withdrawn their combat forces from Afghanistan, leaving behind advisors to shore up an Afghan communist regime headed by President Najibullah, a former secret police chief. The war between Mujahideen guerrillas and the communist government in Kabul continued, but increasingly the guerrillas fought among themselves. They anticipated victory and competed for its prospective spoils. Massoud was perhaps the most politically savvy faction leader, the one who followed precepts of successful guerrilla leaders throughout history. He was a brilliant battlefield tactician, but he was equally concerned with food supplies and security for his civilian followers, and with his popular credibility. Because Sully was bright and had already taught himself English, Massoud's lieutenant sent him to Pakistan in 1992, on a course provided by the United Nations titled Post-Conflict Reconstruction and Management. Saleh studied how to run humanitarian operations in the eventual service of northern Afghanistan. Gradually, Saleh became the youngest man in Massoud's circle of advisors. In the mid-1990s, he moved to Russia. He learned Russian and tried to evaluate the potential for a new partnership with Afghanistan's former tormentor. Russia had fallen into political and economic chaos under President Boris Yeltsin, and Saleh returned to the Panjshir unconvinced that the Russian government could provide much help. Later, Massoud dispatched Saleh to attend peace negotiations with the Taliban sponsored by the United Nations, and Saleh began to work with the CIA. The main CIA unit tasked to interact with Massoud's guerrillas was called Alex Station. Its mission was to capture or disrupt Osama bin Laden and other al-Qaeda leaders. The station comprised about 25 operations officers and analysts, and it was based at CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia. Richard Blee, an experienced operations officer from the Africa Division of the Clandestine Service, took charge of ALEC in 1999. He inherited a group under rising pressure. After al-Qaeda bombed American embassies in Africa in 1998, CIA officers working with foreign intelligence services from Egypt to Jordan to Kenya to Pakistan conducted raids on the homes of suspected al-Qaeda members and associates around the world. They seized computer drives and documents in Arabic, Urdu, English, and other languages, and then dumped the materials on ALEC Station to be sifted line by line for clues and names that might help to thwart upcoming terrorist attacks. By 2001, the station's analysts transmitted an average of 23 formal reports per month to the FBI about al-Qaeda. The work combined high stakes with numbing detail. Senior officers found that if they did not work from 7 a.m. until 6 p.m. or later, Monday through Friday, plus a few hours on Saturday and Sunday, they could not keep up with the traffic. Blee had served multiple tours working the streets and unstable capitals. His CIA tours had included postings to Bangui, the capital of Central African Republic, Niamey, the capital of Niger, Lagos, Nigeria, and Algiers. Blee was tall, with sandy hair. Some of his colleagues found him aloof and entitled. He was a second-generation CIA officer, pegged by some to rise high in the agency eventually. He was cerebral and well-informed about international affairs, comfortable working in ambiguous conflict zones. Considering the problem of al-Qaeda's sanctuary in Afghanistan, a landlocked nation where the United States had no embassy, Blee strongly favored working through Ahmad Shah Massoud, the most effective Afghan commander on the ground, who shared the CIA's antipathy toward bin Laden. Blee had led a covert team of CIA counterterrorism officers who flew into the Panjshir to meet Massoud in October 1999. "We have a common enemy," Blee had told the commander. "Let's work together." He and CIA officers who followed provided power supplies for Massoud's intelligence equipment, better intercept gear, and an encrypted communications link that connected Massoud's intelligence aides to ALEC Station to send and receive secure typed messages. There was one encrypted terminal in Dushanbe and a second in the Panjshir. Massoud assigned Amrullah Saleh to be Blee's main contact. The following year, al-Qaeda suicide bombers supported from Afghanistan struck an American warship, the USS Cole, in the Yemeni port of Aden, killing 17 American sailors. After that, in December 2000, Blee had drafted plans at the request of the expiring Clinton White House for a $150 million covert action program to arm, equip, and train Massoud for missions beyond the bin Laden hunt, to help him fight the Taliban more effectively. Yet many American and European intelligence officers, generals, and diplomats did not see Massoud as a viable partner against al-Qaeda. Recalling the miserable fates of Imperial Britain and the Soviet Union, they did not want to entangle the United States in Afghanistan's civil war. The Panjshiris had committed mass killings during a period when they shared power in Kabul during the mid-1990s. They continued to smuggle gems and heroin to fund their war. Massoud's warnings about al-Qaeda could be dismissed as an element of a self-interested diplomatic campaign to win international aid for his losing factional struggle. Blee became one of Massoud's most ardent defenders in Washington, regarding the commander as a great historical figure, comparable to Che Guevara. Massoud's wispy beard had grown gray, and dark bags hung beneath his eyes, but he remained highly energetic on the battlefield. Massoud's argument was that the United States had a huge problem in Afghanistan, much bigger than bin Laden. The essence of Massoud's message was, "You've got all of these extremists. You've got the Taliban. And I'm the only friend you've got in this neighborhood." Blee agreed with Massoud entirely, but he could not win the foreign policy argument in Washington. He told Massoud, "Look, nobody gives a damn about Afghanistan. They care about bin Laden. I can't talk to you about taking over the government of Afghanistan. I'm only empowered to talk to you about getting bin Laden. But we can build on that. Who knows where that goes?" Massoud understood. All of his allies and foreign suppliers were constrained in one way or another. Alex Station ran some of its covert operations against al-Qaeda, including Predator drone surveillance flights, from the CIA station in Tashkent, Uzbekistan. Amrulla Saleh worked with officers there as well as those in Virginia. That summer of 2001, amid the frustration over America's hesitancy to back Massoud fully, Saleh fell into conversation with one of Rich Blee's colleagues, Jim Lewis, a counterterrorist center case officer posted to Tashkent. Lewis urged Saleh to watch The Siege, a 1998 movie about terrorism written by the journalist and author Lawrence Wright and starring Denzel Washington and Bruce Willis. In the film, a terrorist group carries out bombings inside the United States, and the government imposes martial law. Lewis predicted, "Something similar to that will happen to my country. But nobody is listening to us." From Frankfurt, Saleh returned to Dushanbe. He met Massoud there on Friday, September 7th. Massoud had arrived to speak with a visiting Iranian delegation. In the absence of more robust American support, Massoud depended on Iran, India, and Russia for weapons, money, and medical aid. Iran was perhaps his most reliable ally. Iranian Revolutionary Guards and intelligence operatives worked in northern Afghanistan alongside Massoud's guerrillas. While they were together in Dushanbe, Saleh asked Massoud, "Where shall I send the equipment?" He was referring to the CIA's latest gear. Massoud told him to keep it in Tajikistan for the time being and to invite some Panjshiri colleagues up to Dushanbe. "You can train them," Massoud instructed. That weekend, Massoud returned to Afghanistan, to his compounds near the Tajikistan border, in Khoja Bahuddin. Two Arab television journalists carrying Belgian passports had been waiting there for days to interview the commander. On the morning of September 9, 2001, Mohammed Arif Sarwari, who was commonly referred to as Engineer Arif, because he had studied electronics at a technical university in Kabul before dropping out to join Massoud at war, was at work in his basement office, where he oversaw a wire-strewn rat's nest of ultra-high-frequency radios, intercept boxes, and satellite telephones. Arif was Massoud's senior intelligence operations leader, in charge of all reporting agents and intercept collection in the day-to-day war effort. Arif was a gregarious, energetic man with thinning hair. A CIA officer who worked with him called Arif scruffy, verbose, crafty, corrupt, and a good, reliable partner. He was born to a Panjshiri family in Kabul in 1961 and grew up in Karte Parwan, the neighborhood where Ahmad Shah Massoud had also lived as a boy. When the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan in 1979, Arif was still in school. But in 1982, he left for the Panjshir to join the rebellion. Initially, he worked as a guard and a clerk. But after a year, when Massoud learned that he was from a trusted Panjshiri family, spoke Russian, and knew electronics, the commander asked him to set up a listening post in the Panjshir to monitor Russian military communications. The British Foreign Intelligence Service, MI6, had recently provided Massoud with a Jaguar high-frequency radio network and computers. Someone needed to organize all this equipment and make tactical use of the intercepted messages. Arif became the Panjshir Valley's de facto intelligence chief, often at Massoud's side. Besides managing radio intercepts, he developed human sources. During the war's late stages, Massoud built secret ties to an Afghan communist faction in Kabul known as the Carmelites. When the communist regime collapsed in the spring of 1992, Massoud seized Kabul. For the next 4 years, Massoud served as Afghanistan's Minister of Defense, while Engineer Arif worked as the number two at the Afghan Intelligence and Security Service, formerly known as Qadamati Alayati Dalati, or Government Information Service, but notorious across the country by its acronym, KHAD. Its officers carried out brutal interrogations and thousands of extrajudicial executions during the communist era. Arif kept some Soviet-trained communist veterans in place. After the Taliban took Kabul in 1996 and Massoud retreated back to the Panjshir, Arif maintained contact with some of the former KHAD officers he had worked with. Some of them now served as agents behind Taliban lines. Arif sent small satellite phones to agents in Kabul and Kandahar and arranged for them to cross into Panjshir to meet Massoud personally. "Are there Pakistani troops?" Massoud would ask. "What about Al-Qaeda? What are their ammunition supplies?" Kabul was particularly easy to penetrate because of its mixed ethnic makeup and its proximity to the Panjshir. One of Massoud's reporting agents was the head of all intelligence for the Taliban in Kabul. Massoud owned thousands of books and was devoted to Persian poetry. In the early hours of Sunday, September 9th, he stayed up with an old friend, a longtime political aide named Massoud Khalili, and read poetry aloud in a bungalow, as the two of them did regularly. The next morning, the commander summoned Engineer Arif to ask what should be done about the United States, how to advance that relationship, what the issues were, what strategy to pursue. The Communications and Radio Intercept Center Arif ran was located on the ground floor of a concrete house he used as an office when he stayed in Khoja Bahauddin. There was a reception room upstairs. Massoud said he was finally ready to grant the visiting Arab journalists an interview. The journalists set up their tripods and cameras in the room just above Arif's intelligence center. It was by now almost noon. Arif was in and out. At one point, the commander took a call on his satellite phone. He learned that a Taliban and Al-Qaeda force had attacked their front lines near Bagram Airfield, and that 8 Arabs had been seized. He asked Arif, "See what you can learn about the fighting." Arif went downstairs. He was on the satellite phone when suddenly an explosion knocked the phone out of his hand. At first he thought it was a bomb dropped by one of the Taliban's handful of fighter planes or an enemy rocket launched from long distance. Such attacks were commonplace in Khoja Bahauddin. Then Arif smelled smoke and heard guards shouting. He ran upstairs to the reception room and saw Massoud's body lying inert, blood everywhere. His friend Khalili, who had been translating for the commander during the interview, also lay unconscious. Arif called out for the commander's Toyota Land Cruiser. He and other men carried the victims outside. They laid Massoud on the back seat of the Land Cruiser and put Khalili in the third row seat. As they drove off, Arif called for a helicopter. He ordered the driver to head for a landing area 5 or 6 minutes away. By coincidence, there was a helicopter in the air nearby. "It's an emergency," Arif said. "We're going to need that helicopter, but tell them not to shut down the engines. We're coming." They loaded the wounded men aboard. Arif tried to prevent the helicopter pilots from learning what had taken place. He told them to fly straight to a hospital not far from Khoja Bahauddin that had been built by the government of India and to land in the garden. Then he returned to his office and raised General Fahim Khan, Massoud's most important military commander, on a satellite phone. Arif used the code word they employed for Massoud. "Something has happened to Khalid," he said. September 9th is Independence Day in Tajikistan, a government and business holiday, so Amrullah Saleh was at home when his phone rang. It was a nephew of Masood's. "Don't waste time packing. You are ordered to rush to the airport and fly to Kulyab, a city in Tajikistan about 120 miles southeast of Dushanbe." Saleh left immediately. In Kulyab, still following cryptic instructions, he made his way to a hospital. He found four or five of Masood's commanders and aides there. A little later, General Fahim Khan arrived. Engineer Arif turned up near sunset, his clothes still covered in blood. A liaison officer from Tajikistan's intelligence service joined the group, as did an officer of Iran's Revolutionary Guards. Abdullah Abdullah, a medical doctor and the longtime foreign policy advisor to Masood, who ran many of his overseas liaisons, had been summoned from a diplomatic trip to New Delhi. For the first time, the commanders told Amrullah Saleh the truth. Masood was dead. His corpse was inside the hospital. They had flown the body up from the Indian hospital on the Afghan border. In the garden, they talked about what to do. There were now about a dozen of them gathered. They were in shock. Some of the men wept. Al-Qaeda and the Taliban had tried to kill Masood many times before, but he had seemed invincible. The two Arab suicide bombers, who had been prepped for their martyrdom by Al-Qaeda, had hidden their explosives in their camera equipment. As they talked, the Panjshiri leaders concluded quickly that they would have to lie publicly about Masood's death. They would have to put out word that he had only been lightly injured and would survive. Otherwise, they feared that their fighters on the front lines at the mouth of the Panjshir Valley, facing a mass of Taliban and vicious, death-seeking Al-Qaeda volunteers, would panic and retreat, allowing the Taliban to swarm into the valley and carry out a slaughter. The Iranian Revolutionary Guards advisor with them volunteered that if it seemed too difficult to keep the secret of Masood's killing while his corpse was lying in Kulyab, the guards and Tajikistan's intelligence service could transfer the body to Mashhad in Iran, and keep his death secret for 1 month, 6 months, whatever you need. Others in the group suggested that they move the corpse back to the Panjshir Valley. Yet this carried the danger that the truth would leak out prematurely before they had prepared commanders on the front lines. Abdullah had no doubt that the resistance would collapse if news spread that Masood was gone. The officer from Tajikistan intelligence said there was a morgue nearby the hospital. They could secretly keep the body there for at least a few days while Fahim consulted with commanders. They all decided that was the best plan. They also agreed to inform the six countries that were most important to their cause about what had really happened: the United States, Russia, Iran, India, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan. They gave instructions to Amrullah Saleh. Call the CIA. Tell them the truth about Masood's assassination and ask for weapons. The argument Saleh was to deliver to Alex Station was, in essence, if resistance to the Taliban and Al-Qaeda means something to you, we can hold. We can fight. We will fight. But if you wanted to help Commander Masood only, he is not with us anymore. To compensate for his loss, we need more help than in the time when he was alive. Saleh flew back to Dushanbe and put a message in for Richard Blee at the CIA's counter-terrorist center. He said he needed to speak urgently. When Blee called on an encrypted line, Saleh followed the script given to him at Kulyab. He confirmed to Blee that Masood was dead, but emphasized that Panjshir's leaders wanted to keep the news secret as they tried to forestall a collapse of their lines. After they hung up, Blee notified the White House. Within hours, news services quoted anonymous Bush administration officials saying that Masood had probably been assassinated. Saleh called back. "You are causing me great difficulty with my comrades," he said evenly. "My instructions were to keep this secret." Blee agreed that it was unfortunate. The CIA was obligated to inform policymakers of such important information as soon as it arrived, but the agency had no control over how the White House or State Department handled reporters' questions. Saleh pressed. He knew that Blee and Alex Station had advocated for arms supplies to Masood, and had earlier taken their arguments to the White House and lost. But the Bush administration had now settled in, and here was a new threat to American intelligence collection on bin Laden. If the Panjshir fell, the CIA would lose a vital listening station. Would America try to save the Council of the North, or would it lead the Panjshiris to their fate?
"The decision is that we will fight," Sally said. "We will not surrender. We will fight to our last man on the ground." This resistance was not about Massoud. It was about something much, much bigger. We will hold.
Saleh was putting together a list of the weapons and logistical supplies they needed most urgently.
"What can you do for us?"
Blee said he understood the question. It was Monday, September 10th, the beginning of a new working week in Washington. He would need a day or two.
"Let me come back to you on this," he said.
Chapter 2. Judgment Day. On September 11th, Alex Station held down a small area of the DCI Counterterrorist Center, a windowless expanse of cubicles and computers on the ground floor of the new headquarters building. It was the worst office space at the CIA, in the opinion of some who worked there. It felt like a bunker. During the last days of the Cold War, the Soviet East Europe Division had occupied the floor. Its impermeability would thwart the KGB's eavesdroppers, the thinking went. The CIA's Russia hands eventually found better quarters, and CTC moved in. The center was a bureaucratic stepchild. It had been founded in 1986 as an experiment, a place where analysts, typically writers and researchers with graduate degrees but no operating experience on the street, might work alongside or even supervise case officers, also known as operations officers, the career spies who recruited agents and stole secrets. The CIA's case officer cadre enjoyed the greatest prestige and power at the agency. It was not natural for them to collaborate with analysts. It was akin to creating teams of detectives and college professors to solve crimes. Senior CIA leaders advised newly minted case officers to avoid CTC because being assigned there might inhibit promotions and overseas assignments. Yet during the late 1990s, as terrorism evolved amid post-Cold War disorder, the Counterterrorist Center's budget more than doubled, including one-time supplemental appropriations, while the rest of the CIA dealt with flat or declining budgets. By September 2001, there were about 350 people working at CTC. About three or four dozen worked in overseas stations, but most of the rest were jammed into the new headquarters bunker. Besides Alex Station, the center housed branches and sections assigned to Sunni extremist groups other than Al-Qaeda, such as Hamas, as well as ideologically diverse groups such as Hezbollah, a Shiite Islamic faction based in Lebanon, Colombian guerrillas, mainly Marxist and secular yet operating within a Catholic country, the Tamil Tigers in Sri Lanka, Hindu and ethnically nationalist yet fighting for autonomy in a Buddhist-majority country, the Japanese Red Army, a fragment of the Cold War, and more than six dozen other targets. The office featured low-grade industrial carpeting and cookie-cutter government cubicles. It was poorly lit and smelled vaguely sour. Wanted posters of grim-looking terrorist fugitives, including Osama bin Laden, decorated the walls. In an attempt at relief, someone had mounted fake windows looking out on beaches and palm trees. A job at CTC came with a certain dark glamour and a life-saving mission, but the federal government's general schedule salaries were no better than at the Department of Agriculture. The CIA's bureaucracy was thick and intrusive. The agency's counterintelligence division, charged with detecting traitors and other abusers of security clearances, surveyed the workforce and administered polygraphs that could be highly unpleasant, no matter how diligent and loyal the person examined might be. Mid-level CIA managers could be lazy or cantankerous or stupid or all three. Federal employment rules made it difficult to do anything about poor performers, short of proof of theft or felony violence. Overall, CTC's employees liked their jobs better than typical CIA employees did in the summer of 2001, according to an internal survey. They knew their mission mattered. Yet Alex Station's analysts suffered from information overload. They handled more than 200 incoming cables a day from other parts of CIA, plus another 200 or more from the Pentagon, State Department, the National Security Agency, and elsewhere. Dozens of these were action cables, requiring a prompt reply or follow-up. The analysts often felt stressed. About a third of CIA employees overall felt they handled too much work, but at Alex Station, almost 6 in 10 felt that way. The pressure and the sense of foreboding that informed office life at Alec was not felt widely across the government or in Congress. The analysts and operators were strikingly small in number, considering that Al-Qaeda had carried out several successful attacks against the United States, claiming hundreds of lives. Alec and its counterparts, equally modest in number, at the National Security Council, the FBI, and the National Security Agency were largely on their own, to grind out whatever detection, arrests, and disruptions they could deliver. The CIA's counterterrorism operations in the summer of 2001 often resembled the surveillance operations and criminal investigations carried out domestically by the FBI, with the difference that CTC typically worked overseas, clandestinely, often without regard to the laws of other countries. A common CTC operation involved intensified intelligence collection on a terrorist suspect in an impoverished, unfriendly city like Khartoum or Karachi. That meant operators built a file on a suspect by observing his movements and taking clandestine photographs of his visitors. They might also work with the National Security Agency to tap his phones or hack into his bank accounts or bribe a clerk for the records. A special roster of CIA independent contractors, ex-soldiers, ex-cops, and assorted other adrenaline junkies, carried out the riskiest surveillance and break-in work overseas, because full-time case officers, if caught in the act, likely would have their mugshots publicized by the host government, rendering their expensive training and years in the making cover stories useless. In comparison to career case officers, the contractors were sort of cannon fodder, as one of them put it. Some of them specialized in area familiarization, as it was called, meaning long stakeouts and detailed mapping of a suspect's neighborhood, routes, and routines. The CIA operative also observed local police and intelligence services, so he could plan how to get away if caught. If burglary or planting a listening device was called for, that required a specialized CIA team that resided offshore. These contractors were trained to break into a home or office or embassy, plant a device or steal documents, and get out of the country as fast as possible. The CTC analysts in the basement of new headquarters supported these surveillance and profile-building operations by assessing and logging the photos, wiretaps, and reporting cables that poured in. If CTC wanted to take a suspect off the streets, it typically relied on friendly governments to make arrests. But the center also had the capacity to detain and transport individuals on its own in a procedure called rendition. The CTC's renditions branch would sometimes transfer a terrorism suspect from one country to another for interrogation, including to countries like Egypt, whose military dictatorship had a stark record of torturing detainees. The director of CTC that summer was Kofor Black, a former Khartoum station chief who had worked the Al-Qaeda account on and off since the mid-1990s. He was 6'3", perhaps 20 pounds overweight, with thinning hair and a pasty skin tone, befitting a man whose office along one of the basement's walls now ensured that he rarely saw the light of day. His father had been an international airline pilot. Black had spent his childhood in Germany and England before attending boarding school. He had joined the CIA after studying international relations at the University of Southern California. He had spent much of his career as an operations officer in the Africa Division, managing American allies, supplying arms, and working on Somalia's conflicts. The CIA's Africa Division also recruited Soviet, Chinese, Cuban, North Korean, and Iranian diplomats, spies, or defense attachés who were posted to African embassies, where the targeted individuals were far from headquarters and susceptible to compromise. During the Cold War, the division had a reputation among young operations officers as an exciting, unrestrained